From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a talk with Oscar Arias about his continuing efforts to bring peace to Central America. While he was president of Costa Rica, he got the heads of all the Central American countries to agree to a peace plan, and he won a Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. Much of Deborah Amos's work has to do with war. As a reporter for National Public Radio, she's covered the Gulf War, the Civil War in Lebanon, and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. In part two of our conversation, Amos tells us what it's like to be a woman journalist reporting from Islamic countries. And book critic John Leonard reviews Wall to Wall, Mary Morris's memoir of her travels through China and the Soviet Union. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A former U.S. intelligence official pleaded guilty today to withholding information about the Iran-Contra affair from Congress. Alan Fiers, the former chief of the CIA's Central American Task Force, pleaded guilty to two misdemeanors as part of a bargain with prosecutors. Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh said the plea marked a significant advance in his investigation of the Reagan administration's biggest scandal. Prosecutors said Fiers' plea marked the first time a former CIA official had publicly admitted in court that he knew about the Iran-Contra scheme as early as the summer of 1986. That was months before the White House disclosed that administration officials had sold weapons to Iran and diverted the profits to Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Tensions appeared to be easing today in Slovenia, where local armed forces began handing in their weapons in compliance with an agreement brokered by the European Community. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Ljubljana.
Numerous barricades have been dismantled in Ljubljana, and the demobilization of the 30,000 territorial defense troops should be completed within a few days. Two members of the Yugoslav federal leadership toured the Republic today to monitor implementation of the EC peace plan worked out over the weekend. Although there is some grumbling in Slovenia over the plan, the Republic's parliament is expected to ratify the agreement tomorrow. Leaders here say that rejection of the plan would be a slap in the face of the EC and would rule out European recognition of the self-declared independent state. But there is increasing tension in the Republic of Croatia between Croatians and the minority Serbs. While the biggest republic, Serbia, has indicated it is willing to let Slovenia go off on its own, it will never allow Croatia to secede, keeping one-third of its Serb-populated territory. In Ljubljana, this is Silvia Poggioli.
In Lausanne, Switzerland this afternoon, the International Olympic Committee officially recognized South Africa's National Olympic Committee, clearing the way for South African athletes to participate in the international games. Julia McAvoy reports.
The president of the International Olympic Committee today ended a 21-year ban on the South African Olympic Committee. Reacting to the announcement, IOC Commission member and former ambassador to the UN, Andrew Young, says he believes South Africa has made strides to integrate its athletics.
The National Olympic Committee of South Africa came as an interracial body, pledged to provide adequate training facilities for people of all races, and to promote multiracial sports.
According to the IOC, the end of apartheid laws in South Africa makes it possible for that country's Olympic Committee to comply with the IOC's Olympic Charter. In Lausanne, Switzerland, I'm Julia McAvoy reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 15 points to close at 2,947.23. Advances narrowly edged declines. This is NPR. Administration officials said today that President Bush is expected to accept an independent commission's recommendation that he approve the closing of 25 military bases and 9 research sites across the country. The officials, who asked not to be identified, said the president has invited the commission members to the White House tomorrow when he announces his decision. The president's recommendation will go to Congress, which can vote it up or down, but can't change it. Law enforcement officials in Arizona today released details of a 3-month-long investigation into illegal steroid dealing and use. The probe has led to the arrest of 31 people and the seizure of 3 fitness centers. Laura Carlson of member station KJZZ reports.
The investigation, said to be a first in the U.S., began after the parents of local high school students called Phoenix police, saying they were worried their children were using steroids. 10 agencies, including the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, participated in the probe dubbed Operation Roid Raid. DEA Administrator Robert Bonner says authorities dealt a severe blow to what they say was a regional steroid distribution center involving local fitness centers.
Many of the gyms and health clubs in the Phoenix area, as well as other areas of the country, are providing more than just weights and aerobic exercises. They are retail outlets for illegal steroids.
Suspects arrested in the case are being charged under a new federal law making possession and sale of illegal steroids a felony. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
The Tokyo stock market continued to seesaw today in what analysts say is an ongoing reaction to the scandals at four major stock brokerages. The Nikkei stock average was up almost 2 percentage points after a session of wide swings. Analysts say that smaller investors are staying out of the market, angry at the news that major brokerages gave preferential treatment to their wealthier clients. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Central America is a part of the world in which civil war and military dictatorships have been a fact of life. But there is one Central American country that not only has democratic elections, it has no army, Costa Rica. My guest, Oscar Arias, was the president of Costa Rica from 1986 to 1990. His goal during that period was to bring peace and democracy to the region. He negotiated a peace plan that was accepted by all five Central American nations. The plan opened the way for the 1990 election in Nicaragua. Now, for the first time in 168 years, all of the countries in Central America are ruled by civilian leaders chosen in competitive elections. Arias received the 1987 Nobel Peace Prize. This July 4th, he was given the Philadelphia Liberty Medal for his contributions to the extension of freedoms in other regions of the world. I spoke with him shortly before he was given the Liberty Medal. I asked Arias about the results of the peace talks that have been most gratifying.
Well, the fact that we were able to change Central American history. You know, in 1986, when I came into power, Central American presidents had never met, mainly because of the Cold War. The conflict in Central America was due in part to the Cold War between the West and the East. But also, there was an ingredient of the North-South conflict, the rich against the poor, the rich exploiting the very poor in the region. So with the peace plan, we were able to meet for the first time, to get to know each other, and we were able to understand that it was at the negotiating table and not through violence, not through military means, that we should resolve our differences. So when you look at Central America today, it's a very different Central America, in the sense that when the presidents meet our successors, no longer they talk about ceasefires, amnesties, freeing political prisoners, opening up newspapers which had been closed by dictatorial governments. But they talk about the future of Central America, the economic and social future of the region. So it's a different agenda.
What have your disappointments been since the peace talks were signed?
Well, the fact that there hasn't been the political will to advance much faster. Still, there are negotiations in Guatemala and El Salvador, and in both countries, the parties involved in the conflicts haven't been able to reach a ceasefire. I think that a lot of time has been wasted because still the main obstacle to peace in the region, but this is always true for conflicts all over the world, and this is particularly true in the Middle East today. I mean, the main obstacle is still intransigence, dogmatism, inflexibility, not learning that there is no other way but diplomatic solutions to conflicts, to wars, to violence.
Violeta Chamorro seems to have lost the support of the coalition that helped her get elected, and she seems to have lost it because of her ties with the Sandinistas. What do you see in Nicaragua when you look ahead to the near future?
Well, that was not an easy transition. You know, you don't have easy transitions from one government to another when you have had either a Marxist government or a dictatorial government. This was true for Spain, for instance. This is also true for Chile in South America. A lot of people talk about Nicaragua, but no one mentions Chile. But here you have in Chile a new president, freely elected by the Chilean people, and Pinochet is still the head of the army, the head of the armed forces. So it's not easy for President Aylwin to govern with Pinochet still being the comandante of the Chilean army. This is also true in Nicaragua, with Humberto Ortega remaining as the head of the Sandinista army. So it is not an easy transition. I think that it is not easy for her to govern with a coalition of 14 parties. She still has many problems ahead of her. She inherited a devastated economy. Nicaragua is in ruins. And the sad thing about Nicaragua, and this is true for the whole of Central America, is that that part of the world is no longer important to anyone. So that's perhaps the main problem now, that Nicaragua has been forgotten by the rich countries of the world, that no one cares anymore about Nicaragua because there is peace, there is no longer war, and because, well, war is much more important for the international press than peace. And so Nicaragua, and Doña Violeta in particular, hasn't been able to get or to find the solidarity from the rich countries that she needs in order to reactivate that economy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Oscar Arias, former president of Costa Rica, the winner of the 1987 Nobel Peace Prize. Can you give me a sense of why you thought that you could actually bring together the heads of all the Central American countries and get them together to talk about things like ceasefires and elections? What made you think you could do that?
Well, I had no choice. You know, I came to power in May of 1986, and I had pledged to the Costa Rican people that I wanted to rebuild the economy, to create 30,000 jobs a year, to build 25,000 homes a year, more homes per capita wise than any other country in the whole continent, and that in order to do that, it was for me very important to keep Costa Rica out of the conflicts of the region. So I wanted to play not only a passive role trying to promote peace in Central America, but a more active role. So I decided that Costa Rica had the moral authority because it is the oldest democracy in the region and because it is a country without an army. It is a country where our main values are tolerance and dialogue and trying to solve conflicts always at the negotiating table. So I introduced our own peace plan. It was a very simple peace plan. And the equation was, well, we need peace in order to bring democracy. There will be no democracy in the region unless we put an end to the war, unless we bring a durable peace. And without peace and democracy, there will be no economic development. There were many differences among the different presidents. Nicaragua was a Marxist country, and they were determined to stay in power forever. This is what Daniel Ortega had told me the first time we met. But there is always a first time. I needed Daniel Ortega to sign a peace plan committing himself to hold free elections, and that's what he did. And once he signed that plan, he had to comply with it. There was a lot of international pressure, and when we were able to plan those elections, there were many observers from all over the world. Former President Carter helped a lot to the Central American countries. Those were the most observed elections in the history of Latin America, and those were also the freest and fairest elections in the history of Nicaragua.
Now, I think one of the things you wanted to accomplish for your country in the peace talks was to end military support of the Contras. Now, Contras would slip in and out of your borders. What kind of threat did they pose to your country?
Well, many. You know, I had to take a very difficult decision to ask the Contras either to resign to a military solution for Nicaragua or to leave Costa Rica. Most of them left Costa Rica, abandoned Costa Rica, and came to Miami. I wanted to be very strict on that because my main commitment with the Costa Rican people was that I was not going to tolerate that 1 inch of Costa Rican territory be used by the Contras. And I wanted to be neutral in the sense that I needed the moral authority to be a mediator and to try to bring a peaceful solution to the region. At the first moment, the Sandinistas were very skeptical about our peace plan, in the sense that they always thought it was a plan against the Nicaraguans, against the Sandinistas, but not in favor of the five Central American countries. I don't know if you still remember, but only a few days before our meeting in Guatemala, another peace plan was proposed, and that was the Wright-Reagan plan. This was a plan sponsored by Jim Wright, the Speaker of the House at that time, and President Reagan. So I was very upset, and I told my colleagues in the region that I would only attend a meeting if it was only to discuss our peace plan, the Costa Rican peace plan. They accepted that, and against all odds, we were able to sign the peace plan.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Oscar Arias, the former president of Costa Rica, the winner of the 1987 Nobel Peace Prize for the peace talks that he organized among the leaders of the five Central American countries. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Oscar Arias is my guest. When you became president in 1986, what were your initial contacts like with the Reagan administration? Did the administration send people to see you and to tell you what the United States expected of you?
Well, yes. They expected of me to support U.S. policy in the region. And they weren't very happy when I told them that I was going to oppose that policy, because I had pledged to the Costa Rican electorate and this is why I won that election, that I wanted peace for my country and allowing our territory to be used by the countries would imply no peace for Costa Rica.
What kinds of pressures did the Reagan administration put on you to comply with U.S. policy in the region? And did the Reagan administration give you a sense of what the consequences would be if you didn't comply?
Well, not necessarily. You know, they were very polite and they use very subtle pressures in the sense that we relied a lot on economic aid. And they never dared to tell me, well, if you don't support us, if you don't help us, we're going to cut aid to Costa Rica. But there were many subtle ways how to delay the disbursement of that aid, for instance.
When you were elected, well, after you were elected, you found a CIA-backed airstrip in your country, and you were going to go public about it. What was your strategy about how to deal with this CIA airstrip? And why didn't you want it there? You wanted to shut it down.
Well, again, I had committed myself with the Costa Rican people and with the whole world not to allow our territory to be used by the countries. So I was not going to hide anything. So I told the CIA, I never met Mr. Casey, as a matter of fact, because he wanted to meet me in private, and I didn't accept a private meeting with him.
Why not?
Because I'm not used to that. Because if I was going to meet Mr. Casey, I wanted to meet him in front of the press. I want no secrets with the CIA. So I told the CIA anyway and the State Department that that airstrip had to be shut, had to be closed right away, because I was not going to allow one single inch of Costa Rican territory to be used by the Contras, and that instead I was going to promote a peace initiative, and that's what I did.
What was the initial reaction of the Reagan administration to that?
Well, again, they were not too happy. They were absolutely convinced that the only way to get rid of the Sandinistas was through the Contras. For me, the Contras were the problem, not the solution. For Mr. Reagan, the Contras were always the solution, not the problem.
Now, you were the president of a country in which there's been no army since 1949, a very unusual state for any country to be in. Why was the army disbanded then?
Because we had no need for an army. And I would say that in many countries in Latin America, there is no need for an army. There was a need for an army many centuries ago in order to fight for independence from the Spaniards. There was a need for an army when there was no United Nations, when we couldn't rely on international law to solve most differences among countries. There was a need for an army when there were many border disputes in Latin America. But today we have to find excuses in order to strengthen our armies and keep our armies. Look at the Panamanians. The main excuse some people use in Panama for the Panamanian army is that they need to defend the canal. But to be honest, the Panamanian people and the Panamanian government doesn't need an army to defend that canal, because that canal can be destroyed so easily with or without a Panamanian army. So I am trying to abolish the Panamanian army. And this is, in a way, Costa Rican imperialism, because what I'm trying to do with Panama is to follow Costa Rica's example.
Did you ever feel vulnerable heading a country without an army in an area where you're surrounded by dictatorships and guerrilla wars and so on. Now, I'm sure that's one of the reasons why you wanted the peace talks to succeed. But still, there's been a long history of Costa Rica being in this really unstable region and yet not having an army. So do you feel vulnerable?
Not at all. Who would dare to attack Costa Rica, to invade Costa Rica, knowing that we have no army? You know, we have so many friends, mainly because we have no army, that none of our neighbors would ever dare to invade Costa Rica, knowing that we have so many friends who could come to support Costa Rica if we are invaded. And this is something the Sandinistas always knew. So they never dared to touch Costa Rica. But this is also true, you know, for many other countries. And under the Arias Foundation for Peace and Human Progress, I am trying now to demilitarize the region. If we are able to succeed in abolishing the army in Panama, and I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to succeed, I think it would be very unique for the world, because for the first time in history, two neighboring countries will prove to the world that we both had the courage and the vision to abolish our armies and to teach the rest of the world that armies are not needed.
You don't have an army, but you do have guards, right, who protect the country?
Well, we have a police, a civil police, to deal with criminality, yes.
But there's no border guards? Are there border security forces?
No. You know, the wisdom of not having an army is that we don't spend any money on arms, on tanks, on helicopters, on warplanes, and that's what is expensive, you know. Look at Iraq. I mean, Iraq is spending 700 times more in defense than in health and education. And in most Latin American countries are spending twice or three times more in defense than in health and education. And in the Middle East is not two or three times, but five, six, seven times more in defense than health and education. So you cannot satisfy the basic needs of any society unless you change that. And this is something that must be learned not only by the developing countries, but also by the rich countries, which are the ones who are manufacturing the arms. And those arms will be sold mainly in the next decade to developing countries, to governments in the developing world. And this is something we must stop right now, because otherwise we are condemning those developing countries to remain poor eternally.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oscar Arias is the former president of Costa Rica. Last week he was in Philadelphia to accept the Philadelphia Liberty Medal for his work on behalf of freedom. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a reporter in the Middle East, Deborah Amos had to deal with some things her male colleagues did not. In Iran, she had to wear a veil to do her work. In Saudi Arabia, she was not allowed to drive. Coming up in part two of our conversation, Deborah Amos talks with us about being a woman reporting on Islamic countries in the Middle East. Also, book critic John Leonard tells us if Mary Morris's travel memoir, Wall to Wall, is worth a trip to your local bookstore. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraq says that it hid its nuclear program from UN inspectors because it was afraid that the U.S. and its allies would attempt to bomb its reactors. The Iraqi charges were contained in a letter sent to the UN this week. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports from New York.
In the letter, Iraq admits to having had an extensive nuclear development program that it kept hidden from international inspectors. In the letter, which was made public today, Foreign Minister Ahmed Hussein said Iraq did not reveal the program earlier because of national security concerns. He said that when Iraq had declared its nuclear facilities once before, Israel responded by launching its June 1981 bombing raid on an Iraqi reactor. During the Gulf War, Hussein said the U.S. bombed Iraqi nuclear installations, disregarding the hazards to civilians. U.S. officials today charged that Iraq had still not divulged all of its nuclear capability. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Former President Jimmy Carter says that he believes it's time to lift economic sanctions against South Africa on a very careful basis. The former president says that there appears to be a true and genuine move toward ending apartheid in South Africa, and that this is the first time he has been able to say this. Carter made his comments as he announced a new council for resolving global conflicts. The Bush administration is expected to recommend lifting sanctions against the South African government later on this week, a prospect that concerns some African-American leaders. Speaking at the NAACP convention in Houston, Executive Director Benjamin Hooks criticized the idea, saying that a move to lift sanctions is ill-timed. Bruce Dorton of member station KUHF has more.
Hooks says there have been very positive signs in South Africa, but he says these were brought about by sanctions, and he says it would be criminally irresponsible for President Bush to lift them now. Hooks says he plans to send President Bush telegrams about lifting sanctions. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says President Bush will lift the sanctions if he determines that South Africa has released all political prisoners. But Hooks questions whether all the conditions have been met, including the release of political prisoners. Hooks says South Africa has taken steps to move away from apartheid, but he says if you want to see progress stop, you lift sanctions now. He said sanctions brought South Africa to the negotiating table, and we need them until we get a little farther down the road. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Houston.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 15 points to close at 2,947.23, on volume of some 151 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. In Los Angeles, Police Chief Daryl Gates says that while one day he will retire, he has no plans to step down now. His comment came after a new commission report called for a major overhaul of the Los Angeles police force. Citing what it called a siege mentality, the panel broadly criticized police leaders and said that there is a culture in the organization that emphasizes crime control over crime prevention, and that isolates the police from the community and the people they serve. The commission, appointed by Police Chief Gates and Mayor Tom Bradley, held a number of public hearings and reviewed more than 1 million pages of documents. President Bush's doctors give the chief executive a clean bill of health, but they have also given him new medication to compensate for his nearly destroyed overactive thyroid gland. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Doctors have put the president on a daily dose of a synthetic thyroid hormone known as Synthroid after the radioactive iodine treatment has all but destroyed his own overactive thyroid. That condition was diagnosed in early May after the president complained about an irregular heartbeat and was hospitalized for 2 nights. The president is still taking some heart medications. Doctors say they will be discontinued once his thyroid functions are completely stabilized. The president's personal physician, Dr. Burton Lee, said the president remains in excellent physical health and is suffering no side effects from his medications. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The oldest zoo in the world, the London Zoo, may have to close next year. Officials say that that facility needs $21 million to ensure its short-term survival, but the government has refused to come up with the money. A spokesman says unless more funding is found, the zoo will close in September of 1992. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. She dodged bullets while covering the civil war in Beirut. She thought she might die the first night of the war in the Gulf as she put on her gas mask and waited for the Scuds to hit Tehran. After 10 years of covering hotspots around the world, Deborah Amos has decided to take a leave of absence from National Public Radio. She will be a Nieman Fellow at Harvard and has already begun to work on a book. Yesterday, Deborah Amos told us about some of her experiences covering the Gulf War for NPR. Today we find out what it was like for her as a woman journalist in Islamic countries. Now that she's back in the States, she's experiencing some culture shock.
You know, I find myself looking on the street, people in shorts, people in sleeveless dresses, and I think, my God, they look half naked. And it's funny that you take on that same viewpoint of the cultures where you've been. It's very shocking to me when I come to New York City and see the way people are dressed. And I forget that it's okay for me to talk to a taxi cab driver, and it's okay for me to talk to the man who's at the dry cleaning shop. It's all the things that you do to sort of get along. And in the Middle East, you don't do that. It's an invitation, and you learn very quickly that that's a bad thing to do. I remember being in Israel once, and I was so good about not paying attention to anybody talking to me on the street that I heard a bunch of men behind me, and they were yelling at me, and I paid no attention until I looked down and I realized that I had walked into some wet cement, and they were trying to warn me. But I was so determined that they weren't going to bother me that I didn't even hear them.
Well, if you can't even talk to the person behind the desk at the dry cleaning place, how do you get the information that you need?
You can talk to them. Let me not go that far. But there's a way. There's no eye contact. You don't smile. You don't have those little pleasantries that you might when you go into the local 7-Eleven for a cup of coffee. It's a different kind of relationship, and you're very careful about the way that you present yourself to men in the Middle East. And if you do it, you pretty much can cut out all kinds of harassment. As a matter of fact, you can keep it to pretty much zero. It's a different story when you go and talk to Arab officials. I think in some ways, being a woman in the Middle East actually works to your advantage. We are a novelty, and there are government officials who will welcome you, who will see you far out of who I represent. I don't know how many Arab officials have ever heard of National Public Radio. It certainly helps a little bit more if you work for the New York Times. But being a female correspondent, they're curious about you. They want to know how you think. They want to know how you behave. They want to know how you conduct yourselves. And in some funny way, you are less threatening to them than your Western male counterparts. So I found that it worked to my advantage.
Because you were a novelty.
A novelty, and it also meant that I could see both populations. I could go to a home, a very, very conservative home, and I could go see the women. Now, my male colleagues could not do that, and they were missing a whole lot of the story in a lot of countries. Afghanistan comes to mind, Saudi Arabia, absolutely true. I could just get away with a lot more.
You wore a full-length veil occasionally to do stories, right?
Yeah, in Iran you have to. You can't get off the plane without them.
How does the world look and feel different when you're covered basically from head to foot by a veil?
I think if I had to do it all the time, I would rebel in the way that you see Iranian women rebel by teasing the front of their hair so that it sticks out from their veil. It's a political statement. I think as a reporter, in Iran I felt this very much, you become invisible. I could go almost anywhere I wanted if I was dressed properly because being dark-haired and dark-skinned, I looked as much like an Iranian as anybody else. And I liked the invisibility. There's something that's compelling about that. Nobody looks at you. I do sometimes think that the argument that the veil stops sort of the sexuality that is so prevalent in Western cultures is correct. Where I disagree is that in those cultures, it's not yours to give away. The reason that you hide it is not because you own it. It's because your husband or your brother or your father owns it. And that's where I have my political differences with it. But I don't really mind wearing it on the street when I'm going about my work.
Did you get a sense that the women cared for the things that they were missing, knew that what they were missing, and felt deprived of it?
It depends on what they knew. I think in Afghanistan, and I'll say that this was in Pakistan, this was in refugee camps in Pakistan. Some of these women had come from Kabul where they didn't have to wear the veil. They felt, I think, the most deprived because they understood what they were missing and they were angry that conservative Pakistani culture meant that they had to don the veil again. I think in Saudi Arabia, I certainly met women, two categories, one who didn't know what they were missing and weren't bothered by it. And two, there were young Saudi women, very religious, who had decided to turn their back on Western culture. They chose to not only wear the veil that covered their hair, but they chose to wear a veil that covered their face. In their minds, it was a return to Islam. It was a fundamentalist act. And it was a political one as well. And it was a choice on their part. Look, I think this issue is so complicated and has so many nuances to it that it's really hard to say you're for it or against it or they're wrong and we're right. I think that it depends on the individual. And if somebody chooses, who am I to say that they're wrong?
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Amos. And she's been with NPR for many years. She's on a one-year leave now. She covered the war mostly from Daran, and also she was in Kuwait just right after it was liberated. She's been reporting from the Middle East for about 10 years. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. NPR reporter Deborah Amos is my guest. She's on a one-year leave from NPR after covering the world's hotspots, especially in the Middle East, for many years. In Saudi Arabia, where you were based during the war, there are religious police. How do they operate? What is their beat?
Well, their beat is the streets of the cities, and they have a character that coincides with the character of the town. Jeddah has an international flavor about the city. They are used to foreigners. It's a place that has Henry Moore statues along the seaside. And there, the religious police are not nearly as active as they are in Riyadh. Riyadh is the Quran Belt. It's the heartland of Saudi Arabian conservatism. And here, the Mutawa take their jobs very seriously. And they stand outside of shopping malls in Saudi Arabia, and they wait for women to come by, and they check to make sure that your abaya, the black cloak that you wear, is long enough and covers everything. And people tell just god-awful stories about them. A Saudi man told me that his wife was pregnant, and so her abaya, of course, was raised up a bit by her tummy. And the Mutawa pounced on her and said that she was absolutely flagrantly violating Islam's code and she should go home and get another one. And so some of them are incredibly strict. Some of them are volunteers. And the reason that they do this is because it gives them a sense of power. And they like to cruise the streets and find people who they say are working against Islam.
Were you ever stopped by the religious police in Saudi Arabia?
Oh, yes.
What kinds of things were you stopped for?
A friend of mine and I went to one of the big shopping malls in Riyadh, and it was cold, so we went to buy some sweaters. Now, it's against the rules to try on anything in a Saudi store because, God forbid, you should take your clothes off even if you're behind a bank vault if a man is in the store as well. And we were holding up the sweaters to see if they would fit, and a squad of Mutawa like flying weasels, came into the store and began to yell, "This is a Muslim country, this is not America." And I was dumbfounded by it. And I always wore my press pass because I knew that that was what would guard me against the Mutawa. It was never spoken about, but I am absolutely convinced the Mutawa were told to lay off women reporters. I think Saudi Arabia knew that they would get a black eye if all of us were hauled off to religious court. And I held up my press card, and there was a policeman with them, and they backed out of the store, and they left us alone. But foreign women who live in Saudi Arabia have a rough time with them, and they wear the abaya and they wear the headscarf because it's much easier than dealing with these guys.
Did you ever ask yourself how you would be handling stories differently if you were a man doing the same job in the Middle East?
I hope it would be the same. I don't know if that's true, because I think that you get more sensitized and you are sensitive to different kind of issues. I couldn't drive.
Well, that's what I mean, just in terms of access. I don't mean in terms of...
And, you know, sometimes my male colleagues would say, "Well, you could just meet me at the hotel." And I would say, "You don't know that I can't drive, do you?" And they wouldn't. They would forget that we couldn't do certain things. So you are aware of those kind of issues. You're much more sensitive to them because they're happening to you.
I'm just thinking, if it were me, I'd probably be really angry all the time.
Yeah.
Because I'd be, like, not used to having freedoms like this taken away from me.
Yeah, driving was really tough. I've grown up driving. I've been driving since I was 14. I had a lot of trouble with not driving. And it did make me very angry because it meant that there were real restrictions on me. For instance, my male colleagues could go out into the desert, sneak around the military's restrictions on us because they could go and rent a four-wheel drive. I couldn't do that. So it meant that I was really stuck in the pool system because I had to depend on the military for my transportation, and that made me different.
Do the different values of what men and women can do interfere in a personal relationship when you get used to living in a country where there are so many restrictions put on women? Do you find your own personal relationships get a little out of balance because of the culture?
Yeah, in a very sort of small way, but it makes you think about it. In the early days, there were moments when you could hop in the car of a male colleague to go out in the desert and try to beat the restrictions. And I would find myself asking, would this male colleague let me in the car? Would he think first, oof, if I take her, it'll be dangerous. If I take her, they'll know that I'm a journalist because I've got a woman in the car. And I gave points to my male colleagues who would do it. And I will remember those who wouldn't. And I found this happening with women in the military. They would say, well, when we first got there, you know, our male colleagues would say things like, "Get behind me, woman. It's time to do the laundry." And they would say, "It's not funny." And they'd say, and what they forget is at some moment we're all going home and we'll get them back. So those men who wouldn't roll up their sleeves in solidarity with their female colleagues got lots of points. It was all very small stuff, but it was important.
You said that in the war in the Gulf, there was really only one point where you felt in danger, and that was the first night of the bombing when you were in the shelter with the gas mask, and you'd heard that there'd been a chemical attack on Israel, which there, in fact, hadn't been. In the other wars that you covered, did you have many close calls?
Yeah, the war in Beirut was much more of a shooting war. You could find yourself, caught by sniper fire. You could get in the way of a building being bombed. It was a much different. It was what they call a low intensity conflict, where lots of people can really get killed, and you could be one of them. It was such a different kind of situation than the one that we were in the Gulf War. The Gulf War, it was very clear where you could be and where you couldn't be. There was no way to get where you couldn't be, certainly not in the air war. So you were fairly safe every place else.
Before you started reporting on wars, did you know that you had it in you to be in that kind of situation and, be brave about it and, go about your reporting and everything? It's the kind of thing nobody really knows until they're in it.
No, and it never occurred to me. And I really had to Beirut was the test of it. And I had to think about it later, about why I would have even put up with any of it. And I think that the real answer is that I don't have an imagination. I don't think it has anything to do with courage. But I can't imagine. And so since I can't imagine, I'm not worried about it. I mean, I had a long conversation one night with a colleague who refused to be on a ground combat pool. And I said, why? He said, because I'm afraid of fuel air explosions. I said, you are? He I said, yes, and I'm afraid that if I'm on a ground combat pool that I will be there when one occurs. Well, I knew vaguely about fuel-air explosions, but I couldn't imagine in my mind what one would look like, and I couldn't imagine that I would be in a place where it would suck out all of my breath and burn me into a cinder. Now, my colleague could imagine that, and so he didn't want to have anything to do with it. So in my case, I really don't think it's courage. I just don't think that I can think up those things.
Well, you're beginning a one-year leave from NPR. Are you looking ahead past that year to what you're going to do afterwards?
I'm trying not to. I would like the whole point of this year to not be a preparation for what I'm going to do when I go back, but rather to be a year of reflection. And since I have the rest of my life ahead of me, I got plenty of time to think about what I'll do when I go back. But what I won't have again is 9 months to read and think and reflect and ask all the questions that I couldn't ask when I was working and find out in detail what's happened in other parts of the world where I haven't been paying attention. And the other thing is that I have essentially been out of this country for almost 10 years, and I realize that my Americanness is fading. So part of it is I want to come back and watch television and eat hamburgers and do the things that Americans do so that I can brush up on my Americanness.
Deborah Amos is a reporter for National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have news today of Alan Fires, guilty plea to the Iran-Contra prosecutor. Fires is a former chief of the CIA's Central American Task Force, and his plea might have implications for others under investigation by the special prosecutor. Also, news of President Bush's reported decision to lift the sanctions against South Africa in view of what he considers to be sufficient progress toward ending apartheid to satisfy U.S. law in that regard. And a story from Los Angeles about the Special Independent Commission's recommendation that Daryl Gates, the L.A. police chief, step down in light of the beating of motorist Rodney King.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Five years ago, writer Mary Morris took off on a journey to China and the Soviet Union. Her new book is about that trip. Much has changed in both countries since her trip, but book critic John Leonard says Wall to Wall transcends events and explores more universal subjects.
I'm about to leave town again, and some of the places I'm going to this time, Mary Morris has already been. And it seems to me that she has written something more than a travel book. Wall to Wall is witty and exasperated and self-aware and downright needy. But it also tells us why we go to begin with, why we are not at home. American writers, after all, have been leaving town ever since Washington Irving. If not to kill an Indian or a whale, then to buy a culture fix. Isn't the past cute? Old Europe, Black Africa, and the opiated Orient are boutiques into which we wander with a shopping list. Greek light, German sausage, Russian sole, French sauce, Spanish Bull, The Heart of Darkness, and or a double-knuckled antelope humerus from Moldavi Gorge. We will rub our fuzzy heads against the strange and see if something kindles. And yet, new skies, old eyes. I am a person, Mary Morris tells us, who has always searched for home. Goethe once said that writers are people who have the disease of homesickness, that being a writer is being on a constant search for the place where you belong. Later on, she will embroider this theme. I do not live in a place where my spirits dwell. I have to make this up as I go along. My gods and demons, the witches and caretakers, I do not live in the land where they dwell. I am orphaned, disenfranchised, removed. Like most Americans, I dwell far removed from the source, in deserts where no one knows where we come from, in cities where no one cares. Like the ghost of a restless soul, it seems I must search until I find what I am looking for. Community, family, the place to belong. And so she finds herself in Beijing, alone. The man in her life has left her. She is, she says, a woman in need. She will tell us about the Forbidden City, and we come to realize that we are all of us full of golden lions and stone owls and ancient scrolls and jade figurines, that we have carried a lot of marble on our backs like elephants from Burma. She visits the Great Wall, and we see it as something psychological, a kind of repression to keep out the evil thoughts that come sweeping across the Gobi Desert like Mongols. We've all got our Genghis Khans. She boards the Trans-Siberian Railroad, reading Tolstoy on her way across Russia to the Ukrainian village where her Jewish ancestors knew they belonged, and we are all Anna Karenina. She won't make it to Kiev because of Chernobyl, but meanwhile we've considered our own Siberias, our own St. Basils, and our own Ivan the Terribles, the poets we wanted to be, like Pushkin or Pasternak, the revolutions that happened to us in the winter palaces of our hearts, the canals of ourselves we stare down into, like Morris during her white nights in Leningrad, like Narcissus in Greek myth. In Russia, Morris tells us, when the refuseniks toast, they don't say cheers, they say visa. But from the Great Wall to the Berlin Wall, her voyage is inward. Imagine her surprise, imagine our astonishment, when Mary Morris discovers that she's pregnant. This child, like Chernobyl, wasn't on her itinerary. She'll bring back more than a book. The mother may be in Russia. Her daughter has begun another journey, through another wall, leaving home. You'll find yourself thrilled, grinning, introspective, and maybe envious.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Wall to Wall by Mary Morris. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with associate producers Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He played one of the first great rock and rollers in the Buddy Holly story. He was an almost invincible villain in Lethal Weapon. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actor Gary Busey. He co-stars in the new movie Point Break. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.